Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I'm Amy Sebring, and we'll serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. First, we want to say we would be remiss if we did not note the tragic events of the past couple of weeks. Our hearts go out not only to the families of the victims, but also those public servants who have given their energy and, in some cases, their lives to respond. We are also extremely grateful to the National Hurricane Center for making today's program possible on rather short notice. But first, for any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in the discussion. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel or the chat panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you via private message. Now, today's program is a look back at the 2012 hurricane season and a look ahead to the changes the NHC will implement for the coming season. We will also hear about what is on the drawing board for years ahead. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. And as we go along, if you do think of a question you would like to ask later, you might want to jot that down. Now, today's recording and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Just one moment. I'm trying to bring up the slide deck. Seems to be a little sluggish today. There we go. Okay, now it is my pleasure to welcome Daniel Brown, Senior Hurricane Specialist and Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Hurricane Center. As Hurricane Specialist, he is involved with the issuance of track, intensity, and wind radii forecasts, as well as associated watches and warnings for tropical cyclones in the Atlantic and eastern North Pacific Oceans. His role as WCM includes coordinating NHC's outreach and training activities. Please see today's background for further biographical details and links to several related resources that Daniel will be discussing today. Welcome, Dan, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Well, thank you, Amy, and welcome to everyone that could join us today. I am very excited to be able to provide the presentation to you, and thankfully I did have a lot of this already ready to go on short notice. And it is good to see that the presentation made it on the screen for everyone to see. I'm going to discuss, as Amy mentioned, we'll talk a little bit here about the accuracy of the 2012 forecasts and discuss some of the forecast challenges that the Hurricane Center faced during the 2012 season. We'll focus mainly on the storms that affected the United States. And then later on I'll discuss some of the 2013 product changes. And then kind of lastly, we'll look at some of the in-house experiments that NHC is doing that could potentially lead to some product changes in the future. So let me move here to the next slide. And the good news last year for 2012, when we look back at how the Hurricane Center's track and intensity forecast did, we set several records for track, which is happens often these days as we've been improving our track forecast over the past couple of decades. You can see here that the average forecast area here at 2 days out was only about 69 nautical miles. And one thing we did do last year as well is we set some records for intensity forecast, especially here at the long range at days 3, 4, and 5. That is somewhat more unusual, and I'll talk about that here in a moment, that we have not been making as much progress in our intensity forecasts in the past couple decades. But last year, we did break some records, although some of these records were broken Probably because we didn't have very many rapidly intensifying storms during the 2012 season. So some of these storms may have been a little bit easier to forecast. I will illustrate here how the track forecast errors have been reducing and how our forecasts have been getting better over the past 20 or 25 years. This graph here shows what our track errors at the various time frames are. So the red line here is our average track error at 24 hours, and then the green line is for 48 hours. And this starts back in 1990. And you can see that the average two-day forecast error back in 1990 was about 200 nautical miles, and that has reduced down to what I said a moment ago, about 69 miles here in 2012. So we've been making some great improvements. I'm sure many of you have heard us talk about this in the past. We used to say that we've cut the track errors in half since about 1990, but actually it's even getting to a point where now it's greater than half. Almost the errors have been cut nearly in about by about two-thirds during that time. So really a great success story in being able to forecast a storm's future path and location. On the other hand, as I mentioned, our intensity forecast have not improved much over this same time period. These are the average intensity errors the red line here is 24 hours. The green line here is for 48 hours. And you can see that these trend lines, the dotted lines here, are basically flat, meaning that we really have not improved our intensity forecast over this 20 or 25-year period. There is some good news, I guess, in the very recent time, and you do see some of these errors coming down here very recently. Again, I think the last couple years we have not seen much in the way of rapid strengthening, so you see that these errors have come down some in the last few hurricane seasons, but again, I think that's because we have a little bit easier storms to forecast. I will note, though, that if you look at the blue line here for our five-day, and this line here is our four-day intensity forecast. Those trend lines do show some downward motion, and I think some of that is probably because we improve our track forecast at 4 and 5 days, so we have a better handle on whether the storm is going to be over land or over water, which of course makes a contributes to the forecast error. If we can't get that right, then we certainly would likely miss the intensity forecast. But because the tracks have gotten better, the longer range intensity forecasts appear to be improving slightly, but again, there hasn't been much change for the short term intensity forecast. This is a look at the forecast errors for each storm. So if you look at the storms here, such as a Beryl that was early in the season, those forecast errors here were pretty low, meaning that the storms were some of the more successful storms that we forecast during the last hurricane season. And you can see the average errors at 3, 4, and 5 days here listed by the lines. You can see that there are a few storms that we really struggled with last year, and we'll talk more about these. But one of those was Tropical Storm Debbie that formed in the Gulf of Mexico early in the season. That was a real struggle to forecast where that storm was going to go. I'll show you the model guidance that we had to work with and why that was such a struggle. There were a couple storms that were out, thankfully out to more over the open ocean, that were also more of a struggle, including Kirk and Nadine, which lasted for several weeks. And Isaac, although we did well in the short-range forecast, as some of you may remember, if you're joining us from the Gulf Coast or from Florida, you may remember some of those early forecasts for Isaac were much were more up towards the Florida Peninsula rather than out into the Gulf and Louisiana, where eventually Isaac made landfall. And I'll show some examples and talk a little bit more about that. Sandy, on the other hand, late in season, actually was a fairly good forecast success from a track and intensity forecast perspective, but there were some other challenges that we faced forecasting Sandy. And as you all may know, the dilemma on the watches and warnings, which I will discuss here a little bit later. I'll start out here with Debbie and say that if you're familiar with our graphical tropical weather outlook, which is on the left side of the screen here, This was a well-forecast system that we knew it was going to form. The model guidance did a very good job at forecasting Debbie's formation, but the problem was, where was it going to go? And I'll this other on the top right is the model guidance and how divergent it was, and I'll walk us through that here in just a moment. For those that don't remember, Debbie ended up affecting Florida, and it made landfall as a minimal tropical storm near Steinhatchee, Florida, on June 26. It caused five direct fatalities, but in its main impacts were from both freshwater flooding from a lot of heavy rainfall and also some storm surge flooding. It was just a tropical storm, but it does illustrate the dangers of storm surge flooding, even from a tropical storm along the west coast of Florida, where there was inundation in some areas of 1 to 3 feet. And overall, Debbie caused about $250 million in damage. Here are these model forecasts for Debbie when it first formed. This was the dilemma that we faced here, the first advisory. Thankfully, I have to kind of joke a little bit that I was actually on vacation, so I picked a good day not to be in the office, as this was a very difficult forecast. Two of our better models that we have in the past few years, one of them is the European model, which had its five-day forecast point here over Texas, and the U.S. global model here in black, its five-day forecast was east of the Florida Peninsula. So you can see how divergent the models were. And, again, a couple of these models did like favor Texas, and a few favored Florida. And this made for a very difficult forecast. Our first forecast put a little bit more weight on the European model since it had been the best-performing model over the previous few hurricane seasons. And our forecast showed a little bit more of a track towards the west, which ultimately did not happen, leading to those large errors. And I'll forward a little bit over time. So advisory number two, again, these models were still very divergent, with some favoring Texas, some Florida. And then a lot of people may hear us talk about the consensus models in our tropical cyclone discussions, how we do use kind of the average of many of these different models to help us with track, although in this case it really didn't help, because when you average out the tracks over Florida and Texas, you get a track towards the northern Gulf Coast, which really did not seem plausible in this case. So those were not much of a help either. But over time, as you can see, the model guidance gradually shifted towards the Florida Peninsula, and our forecast, here's all the Hurricane Center forecasts for Debbie, and you can see how we did struggle. And it just illustrates that even today, with the improvements in track that we've seen over the past 20 to 25 years, that there still occasionally are times when the model guidance is very divergent, and we will struggle and have less confidence in the Hurricane Center forecast. And a good way to gauge that confidence is by reading our tropical cyclone discussion product. Hopefully you all are very familiar with that. Just to review a little bit of the impacts in Florida, Debbie was a significant tornado producer. There were a lot of tornadoes that occurred. 24 occurred across the state of Florida. There were, I believe, a couple of deaths that were related to the tornadoes that did occur. And some of these are fairly spectacular pictures that were taken in Florida of tornadoes that were associated with Debbie. And again, the main impacts with Debbie were the water hazards or storm surge and heavy rainfall. This onshore flow that occurred for several days, because Debbie was a slow mover, ended up piling water along the west coast of Florida, and basically from southwest Florida through the Tampa Bay area all the way up into the Florida Big Bend region, ended up getting this onshore flow and storm surge that occurred near the coast, and did cause some problems and damage. Now I'll move over to Hurricane Isaac. I'm sure many more people remember Isaac. Isaac formed east of the Caribbean islands, and it ended up making landfall in Haiti and in eastern Cuba, and then moving up across the Florida Straits, and then making a fairly slow track across the eastern and central Gulf of Mexico, actually slowed down as it approached the Louisiana coast. It did become a hurricane shortly before landfall, And again, its main hazard was also storm surge. We saw storm surge inundation as much as about 10 to 17 feet across Plaquemines Parish in southeast Louisiana and 8 to 12 feet across St. Bernard Parish. And Isaac ended up causing about a little more than $2 billion in damage. And I'll talk a little bit here about some of the challenges we faced. I think the next slide shows some of the pictures of the storm surge that did occur. One thing that was, I think, something to remember with Isaac is that a lot of people, Isaac was a large storm, which does have implications on how much surge it does a storm will produce. And because of its large size, it did produce a rather high storm surge in a very storm surge vulnerable area. Some people seem to be caught off guard because they ended up with more surge from Isaac than they did from Katrina in some areas. But again, I think the reminder there is that it took a track that was different than Katrina, and also its large size helped to contribute to this surge for a storm that was not as intense, say, as Katrina was. But surge was certainly the story there with Isaac. This shows here that the forecast struggles that we had early on in the storm. Some of you may remember that the Republican National Convention was scheduled to occur in Tampa Bay the week that Isaac was scheduled or forecast to be in the Gulf of Mexico area. And the early forecast showed this threat towards the Florida Peninsula. This is the model guidance that we had here when it was just entering the Eastern Caribbean. And you can see all these models that were pointed up towards Florida and the west coast of Florida near the Tampa Bay region, and made the forecast difficult. Also, the intensity forecasts were very tough for Isaac because of the amount of land interaction. And several of our forecasts, especially early on, we had a little bit of a high bias in our forecast because Isaac ended up interacting more with the landmass there of the Dominican Republic and Haiti and also eastern Cuba, making those forecasts even more difficult. But even when Isaac finally exited the north coast of Cuba, there was still a fairly large amount of spread in the guidance for where it might impact the Gulf of Mexico. And this was actually a three-day forecast here with a center here right along the northern Gulf Coast. And you can see that the model guidance was basically indicating landfall from anywhere from, say, the Florida Panhandle region all the way over into southeast Louisiana. So it was a pretty wide area here, even at 3 days, that the model guidance suggested could be impacted by the center of the storm. And at this point, the Hurricane Center forecast was near these kind of the consensus or the middle of the model guidance. And eventually, we did have to swing the forecast a little bit left as the model guidance did come into better agreement towards southeast Louisiana. I will point out here, too, that sometimes if you look in white where the actual track of the storm progressed, it actually is outside of the guidance once you get beyond about 2 days. So, again, that does happen on occasion. The storm actually does move outside the kind of the suite of model guidance. I know a lot of people now do go to the Internet and do look at some of these model plots that they see. But I caution people because I don't think it all the time. It doesn't always show you kind of the entire range of possibilities from a given forecast scenario. So moving forward here, we'll move now into Sandy and talk about Sandy's impacts and also its forecast challenges that we faced. Of course, Sandy was the late October storm formed here in the Central Caribbean, moved northward and began to quickly strengthen as it approached the eastern portion of Jamaica, and then ended up strengthening into a Category 3 storm just before it made landfall in eastern Cuba, and then moved across the Bahamas, weakened somewhat, and actually became a tropical storm for a brief period of time before re-strengthening and then taking this somewhat unusual, actually a fairly unusual track and turn back toward the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast United States. It's transitioned from a tropical cyclone, which gets its energy source from the warm water, into a more of a an extratropical or more wintertime type low pressure area, certainly made for some forecast challenges on how we dealt with the watches and warnings, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And also I'll end with some changes that because of Sandy we will be implementing at the Hurricane Center and the Weather Service this year. But as far as you know, Sandy, again, it did produce hurricane force winds across southern parts of New England, Long Island, at least in gusts, and those winds did knock down trees that ended up killing 20 people. The total death toll in the United States from Sandy was 72, but a little more than half of those deaths were from storm surge, and of course, storm surge was again the primary hazard and what produced much of the damage. With the significant surge occurring basically from the New Jersey coast through New York and into southern New England. This map here shows the inundation values, so really how much water ended up being over land that is normally dry. And the highest values were up here in northern New Jersey and also near the Staten Island area of New York. Here the highest was right around 9 feet. And I did have an opportunity to, a couple of us here at the Hurricane Center, to do an overflight of this area about a week after Sandy, and the devastation was quite striking. It was an awful event for the folks up in that region. Here are some, again, pictures, and I'm sure everyone has seen various damage pictures from Sandy, or perhaps some of you have been on the ground and seen it yourself in person, but it certainly illustrates the devastation that storm surge can bring to a region, and also how widespread that damage can be. As far as the forecast for Sandy, I mentioned earlier that overall the forecasts were pretty good. These are in black here, all the Hurricane Center track forecasts throughout the entire life of Sandy. You can see that there were a few times here where we had it forecast to be a little bit more offshore than it, or a little too far east. But the model guidance picked up on this turn fairly early, and such that we were able to, you know, shift our forecast a little bit back to the west, and then ended up with some very good forecasts several days in advance of its landfall in the United States. The intensity forecast also ended up being very good for Sandy, especially for the approach to the United States. We did struggle, which we often do, with a rapid strengthening that occurred near near eastern Cuba. Here is a slide to illustrate that. Here's the picture of Sandy as it made landfall in eastern Cuba. But this, you can see in this slide graph on the bottom left, in white are all the basically what happened, the intensity of the storm at every 6 hours through its life, and all the lines that are in light blue are the actual Hurricane Center intensity forecast. And you can see what's highlighted in this purple circle, that the Hurricane Center forecast just did not forecast this real rapid change in strength just before landfall, and that is something that we still struggle with. We really don't have the intensity model guidance that can predict these real rapid changes in strength. Really, there's several reasons for this. One is with intensity forecasting, it's really a much smaller scale of phenomena or mechanism that is causing the rapid changes in strength. We can look at the overall storm environment to see whether it's favorable or not, but it really is oftentimes these small-scale things that are going on inside the storm. So it's very difficult to observe that. It's also difficult to model that. We don't have quite high enough resolution models, and there's also still some understanding that we just don't have as to these processes that go on. So it's something that the Hurricane Center and NOAA is working on. As you see on this slide, there's a project called the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Program. And it is trying to tackle some of these issues. It's a 10-year program that hopefully will provide the Hurricane Center with some better modeling efforts, which we are starting to see now in real time. But again, Sandy really did illustrate this this problem we have at forecasting rapid changes in strength. As far as the warning challenge in Sandy, leading up to Sandy's landfall in the United States, our model guidance forecast that Sandy was likely to make this transition from a pure tropical system into this extratropical system, more like a wintertime type low where it gets its energy more from the contrast of air masses and various fronts that are tied to it. And this led to some difficulty because once the Hurricane Center starts issuing warnings, it's very difficult for us to switch between the tropical cyclone or the tropical storm and hurricane watches and warnings and the non-tropical cyclone warnings that are issued by the local weather forecast offices. And really, it left three scenarios that none of them were very appealing during the event. And one was that if this occurred, even if it occurred a couple days before landfall, that the Hurricane Center, once it's no longer a tropical system, would cease to issue advisories, transfer the responsibility to the other local weather offices, as well as the Hydrometeorological Prediction Center. At that point, we would be required to drop the hurricane watches and warnings. And so that was really a solution that we really didn't want to see happen because we heard from a lot of emergency managers and others that they really didn't want to see us change warning type during the middle of the event because that could be confusing. The other possible thing was to just continue calling Sandy a hurricane, even if it really wasn't one. But that could have been even more than a day or two before landfall, as the timing of when this transition would occur was not well known. And we just felt that could really misrepresent the situation and also really damage our credibility, as you can only really stretch the science and also the calling it what it is for so long. And the third would be to actually continue issuing advisories on the system even after it became non-tropical, or what we call post-tropical. We had advertised in years past when we switched to this new naming convention for post-tropicals that whenever we issued a post-tropical advisory, that it would be the final advisory. And so being able to disseminate additional advisories after the one in which we call the post-tropical, we felt could end up breaking some of the dissemination processes that are in place by the media and other other vendors that use our products. And we just didn't know that the flow of information would continue after that transition. So we felt that we shouldn't try that in real time during this. So what was decided by the Weather Service during several meetings was to eventually issue these non-tropical warnings to the north with the forecast that it was going to transition. So the local offices did issue the appropriate high wind warnings cover the event that way. And I'll talk here a little bit about now on what has happened since Sandy's landfall. And you all know that Sandy really transitioned very late in its life over the water and basically transitioned as it was making landfall and became post-tropical just a couple hours before landfall in New Jersey. So what are we doing here to meet this kind of warning challenges for this year and beyond? Well, based on what happened last year, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, but the Weather Service has basically broadened its tropical storm and hurricane watches and warning definitions to now allow them to be used for post-tropical cyclones that do pose a significant risk to life and property. Some of you may have heard about this change already. The Weather Service and NOAA is doing an assessment of its products and services during Sandy, which it typically does for big events. And this question was posed to some emergency managers and users of our products. And preliminary information is that everyone thinks this is a good change, and that's why it is going ahead and being implemented here for 2013. So this is going to give us the option to continue issuing advisory products on post-tropical cyclones that pose a risk to life and property, and also when the transfer of responsibility from the Hurricane Center to to another National Weather Service office would result in this unacceptable discontinuity in service. So, again, it gives us more options in a case such as Sandy in the future. And the other news that you may have heard of is that the Hurricane Center really for several years has been looking at the possibilities of issuing storm surge watches and warnings. And we've been really looking at this for about the past decade, and with many recent storms such as Katrina, Ike, and then Isaac and Sandy this year, just illustrating that we need to get more public response, make sure we get the appropriate public response to actual the hazard that poses the greatest risk to life and property, and that is storm surge. And that's, of course, why we do evacuate from the coast. And so with this and with the events that have recently occurred, the Weather Service has made a decision to move forward with the storm surge watch and warning. This will be issued independently of where the actual hurricane wind warning could be issued. And right now, the target date is for this to be operational by the 2015 hurricane season. And I'll talk a little bit more about this on in a few slides here. Here's kind of the prototype of, again, of the storm surge warning. It would be a warning that would be issued for these, areas right along maybe the coast. This will be in a collaborative process between folks in our Hurricane Center Storm Surge Unit and also the local weather offices around the country. And, again, this is something that is being planned to debut in the 2015 hurricane season. A potential upgrade to our storm surge guidance and products is a storm surge inundation graphic. This graphic is based upon some probabilistic storm surge guidance that is created here at the Hurricane Center, which basically takes the tracks of our forecast track. It looks at our average errors and then takes storms of varying intensities and varying sizes into the coast in various spots to get the chance of, say, what is the chance of surge being X number of feet at this location. Those products are already available on the Hurricane Center website, but this takes that information and provides kind of what the most realistic worst-case scenario is from a potential hurricane landfall. And this graphic is still being fine-tuned here at the Hurricane Center. It has been tested with some focus groups, and I think most people feel that there is a lot of benefit and need for this graphic, and this is something that could potentially be available for a hurricane landfall during the 2013 hurricane season. A final decision has not been made as to whether it will be available for this year or next year, but it may be available here in the 2013 hurricane season. Some other 2013 changes, again, that are going to occur here this season. One of these is that the definitions, as I mentioned here, of the tropical storm hurricane watches and warnings have been broadened and now allow the issuance and the issuance criteria of our advisories. They have changed to allow us here at the NHC the option to use them both for post-tropical cyclones that pose a threat to life and property. As I discussed a few slides ago, so now if we have a similar case like Sandy, we could issue and maintain tropical storm or hurricane watches and warnings for systems that might transition before landfall, and the Hurricane Center can continue to issue the advisory products on that. I'll go over the other three here that are on the slides. This slide here, I'll talk about this new use of our National Hurricane Center Tropical Cyclone Update product. And I'll also talk about a planned extension of the Tropical Weather Outlook out to 5 days here in the next few slides. Whenever a storm was approaching the coast and it was could be tracked pretty easily on radar, the Hurricane Center would issue advisories every 2 hours, and in between those two-hourly updates, there would be a tropical cyclone position estimate product that would come out. It's a text product just to tell you where the storm is located, how many miles it is from a major city, and, again, what the current intensity is and movement is. But in order to streamline our product suite, We actually discontinued this product in favor of issuing this in a current existing product called the Tropical Cyclone Update. So the Tropical Cyclone Update has been issued when unexpected changes occur in the cyclone. If we need to issue international watches or warnings in between advisory times. But now a new use of that will be for these one-hour updates whenever the storm is making landfall and it's it can be fairly easily tracked on radar. And we also sometimes use this product to tell people when landfall has occurred. Oftentimes the media really wants to know when landfall has taken place, and so, again, it's a product that we can use for all those reasons. So it's not a huge change for folks out there, but, again, it's just another place to get kind of a continuous flow of information when a hurricane is making landfall. One change I think all of you will really like for the 2013 hurricane season, this is something that is not going to begin on June 1st. We, over the past few years, have been looking at extending the time period covered by our tropical weather outlook. The current tropical weather outlook covers a two-day or 48-hour period. In the last several years, we've been assigning the chances of systems forming over the next five-day period, kind of behind the scenes. We've done verification of that, and it has proven to be fairly accurate. So beginning this season, some point during the season, we're going to still do some in-house testing, and we also have some technical issues that we need to work out in the early part of the season. But I would think by sometime in the July-August time frame, you'll start to see this in our text product, and that is you'll get a chance of what the system, what the formation potential is for the first 2 days, and then you'll also get this chance of formation over the next 5 days. And I gave you a little bit more information about the longer-term chance of the system becoming a tropical depression or tropical storm. And, again, this is kind of how this will look in the current existing text tropical weather outlook. It makes the paragraphs a little bit longer, but you can see here we mentioned in here, let me see if I can highlight it, this 40% chance of formation during the next 48 hours, and then later on down the paragraph it'll tell you that it has a high chance of 80% of becoming a tropical cyclone during the next 5 days. So, again, you'll get both of these probabilities now in the outlook sometime beginning in July and August. And the other good news is that we are working on a graphic to go along with that. We're not real sure if this will be ready for to debut in 2013. We still have some technical issues to overcome, but this is a prototype of that graphic. The current tropical weather outlook graphic that you see with the satellite image showing the current location of the disturbance will not change, but this graphic here will be in addition to that, and will show you where the disturbance is located currently by an X, and then it will show the area of possible formation over that five-day period, and also show, again, using these low, medium, and high categories, what the chances are. If you click on these, you will be able to actually see what the probabilities are as you click. It'll show a, because some of these areas will overlap, it actually is going to be, each one will have its own separate graphic as well, and you can get the probabilities right on the graphic. But I think this is really, again, a good addition to help people have a little bit more time for planning when systems are forming near land or near the east coast of the United States or Gulf of Mexico. And if anybody has any questions on that when I'm finished, you can certainly ask away. One thing with just remind folks about the forecast cone with our improvements in track forecasting. Our cone continues to shrink in size. It's constructed such that it's constructed by circles that are around each of the forecast times in which two-thirds of the verifying forecast should fall within that circle. And this is based on the five-year error distribution from our previous errors over the previous five hurricane seasons. And as our forecasts continue to improve, the size of these circles has continued to shrink. I would remind folks that storm size has not changed, and it just means that you can get more impacts outside of the cone. We know that the cone is it's a great briefing tool because it provides where the center or the path of the storm is likely to go. But again, it doesn't tell you much about impacts. But with that, with the improvements in track forecasting, the size of the cone is going to change, shrink again by about 3 to about maybe 8 or 9% than it was last year. It's not a huge change. You probably won't notice much. But if you do go back and look at cones from several hurricane seasons ago to today, you'll certainly notice the difference. Here's the cone from Isaac Advisory 13. If it was this has the 2008 cone size on there, and if you look, the edge of the cone is from about Jacksonville, Florida, all the way to extreme southwest Louisiana. Well, if you now move forward and apply what the 2013 cone would look like, you'll see that it is much smaller, stopping here kind of at the edge of the Florida Panhandle and then over central Louisiana. Again, that's not the change from last year to this year, but that's the change over about a five-year period. The change from last year to this year is pretty small, but just to illustrate how the cone has been shrinking over the past really 10 to 15 years since we introduced the cone. I already mentioned, I'll move now into some other potential improvements really beyond the 2013 time period, some in-house experiments that we're working on here at the Hurricane Center. One of those I already mentioned, and that is the storm surge warning being planned for 2015 and inundation graphic. Again, that might be available this season, but if not, it would be available in the, likely in the 2014 hurricane season. Some other things that we're working on here is producing track and intensity forecasts for disturbances, for basically systems that have not yet become a tropical cyclone, and whether or not we could start to issue watches and warnings for those systems. The radar image here on the screen is a system, Tomas, back in 2010, that's formed very near the Caribbean islands and actually strengthened quite quickly and became became a hurricane as it moved over the islands. But it impacted them in such short order that there really wasn't much lead time on the tropical storm and hurricane watches and warnings. So, again, we're looking at ways to maybe be able to issue watches and warnings before a system forms. And we're actually looking at also the extension, as the model guides has gotten better, the extension of our forecast out to 7 days. I'll quickly show you a couple slides on these and then wrap up. This here, again, is this this was a forecast we issued on the upper right-hand corner before Irene actually formed. This was a forecast about a day before Irene, and the black here is this forecast we laid out, and then the actual track is in white. So you can see it. We did a pretty good job forecasting where it would go even before it actually formed. So we started making these forecasts a couple years ago. We've been looking at them in-house. Right now the forecasts are pretty good. They're not as good as our forecast for systems that have already formed for our normal tropical storm and hurricane forecast, but again, it's something we're looking at, and again, at some point we're hoping to maybe be able to issue watches and warnings even before a system forms, and here are a couple kind of prototype graphics of how that might be done. We're still working out the details on this. We don't know whether we'd issue full advisory products for a system like this that's just still a disturbance, or whether we may only issue watches and warnings in one of our existing products like the Tropical Weather Outlook. And again, this would all be in coordination with the local National Weather Service offices. And I suspect this would be still a 2 or 3 years down the road at the earliest. But again, it's something that we are working on and thinking about here at the Hurricane Center. I look at Sandy and what happened with the watches and warnings, and we're kind of fixing that on the back end of a system when a system transitions. This is kind of looking at the watch warning problem as the system forms or at the front end of a system. And lastly here, I'll finish up with 6 and 7 day forecasts. As these models have improved, we have started looking at issuing 6 and 7 day forecasts. Good news, last year we did pretty well on our 6 and 7 day forecasts. So this graph here shows in black are the Hurricane Center verifying 6 and 7 day forecasts. So you can see the average air at day 6 was about 240 nautical miles, and at day 7 the average air from our forecast was about 300 miles. And in red and blue here are our two primary best models that we model guidance that we get. That is U.S. Global Forecast System and the European model. And you can see that we actually did outperform. The forecasters here did outperform both of those models at days 6 and 7. We are planning to do an in-house test on this again this year. I will mention that when you take those 240 nautical mile and 300 nautical mile average errors and you place them back on this graph I showed at the beginning of the presentation, it really shows you that the day 6 forecast is pretty close to what the day 4 forecasts were about a decade ago when we introduced those, and the day 7 forecast of about 300 nautical miles is also now equal to about what the day 5 forecasts were about a decade ago. So, again, I think it shows that we probably will begin issuing 6 and 7-day forecasts in the near future. We haven't decided exactly how we'll do that, and I think that's some discussion that we're still having, whether or not we extend the current cone graphics out to day 6 and 7 or we display these in a different manner, because there is more uncertainty in the longer-range forecast than the shorter-range forecast. And I will caution folks that even though we did well last year, not all forecasts will be perfect. Here is our 6 and 7-day forecast for Sandy. And you can see, again, at this point, there was a large spread. Here's this European model that's was one of the first to show landfall day 7. U.S. GFS models out here in black, off the east coast of the U.S., and at the time, this was the Hurricane Center forecast that's circled in red, and it really was not would not have been a very good 7-day forecast, much higher than that average that I showed on the other screen. And again, by day a day or so later, the day 6 forecast began shifting back toward the U.S. And by day 5, of course, the forecasts were pretty good. So, but you can see at least a little bit of word of caution about the use of 6 and 7 day forecasts and how we might want to display those forecasts. I'll just wrap up here with two quick slides to say that the Hurricane Center is using social media. I know that a lot of emergency management agencies are also using social media. Our social media accounts have been pretty popular. We have about 208,000 followers now on our Facebook page and about 110,000 followers on our Twitter feed. The main Hurricane Center Twitter feed is actually kind of automated and tweets some of our advisory products when they come out. But I would also mention that the NHC Storm Surge Unit and also Rick Nabb, the Hurricane Center Director, they're also very active on Twitter if you'd like to follow them. For those of you that have social media accounts, last couple years we've had we did some public service announcements that were recorded before the hurricane season. This is an example of one. We actually re-recorded those this off season to freshen those up. Those should be released here in the next few weeks via YouTube. Please look for that on our website and through our social media. And I would suggest that it'd be very good. You could use those during National Hurricane Preparedness Week, which is the last week of May. Perhaps on your link on your social media accounts as well. But it talks about the various subjects that are discussed during Hurricane Preparedness Week, and also has some NHC forecasters and Craig Fugate from FEMA doing some of the recordings. Just summarize, it's interesting. I'm sure some of your pages, every time there's a hurricane threat or a major event, you see this uptick in number of followers or users, and that certainly was the case last year with Debbie and Sandy and some of these major upticks in users. Kind of interesting just to follow that. And for those of you that want to see the faces behind the forecasts, I'll leave this slide up as I answer questions. These are your hurricane specialists that you see that the names at the bottom of the advisories. And it's a pretty tight-knit group of folks, and we certainly love and enjoy our jobs and hopefully working with you all to make our coastal residents better prepared and help them make better decisions when a storm is threatening the area. And I'll end with that and take some questions.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Great presentation. And I will come back to this slide in a moment. But first, we're going to our instructions for the Q&A, just real quickly. Please use the Q&A panel. In fact, I'm going to close the chat panel here in a moment. Type in your question or comment, then click on send or hit the enter key. I will read the questions out loud. We generally take them in sequence, and then our guests will respond via the bridge. And let me go ahead and close this. One moment. All All right. We do have a few questions in already. And again, folks, if I butcher your last name, I do apologize. Darren Thrain, he asks, can you touch on what is being predicted for the 2013 hurricane season?
Sure. The NOAA seasonal outlook that is issued jointly here from with the Hurricane Center and also the Climate Prediction Center, that forecast will be issued, I believe, on May 23rd, kind of towards the mid to the late part of May. I'm sure some of you have seen some of the other seasonal forecasts that have been issued to date. Most of these are suggesting that we will have another active hurricane season. I would just throw a word of caution in. Again, I know that others may have heard folks in the Hurricane Center reiterating this, but seasonal forecast really at this point does not tell you where the storms are going to go, where they're going to make landfall. So as coastal residents, as emergency managers, there's really not much that you can do with the seasonal forecast. You really have to prepare each season like you're going to get hit, because it only takes one to hit your area for it to be a bad year. The classic illustration is that you go back to 1992. We only had seven named storms, four hurricanes, one major. It was a very inactive year if you look at in terms of the overall numbers. But that one major hurricane was Hurricane Andrew. Of course, struck South Florida as a Category 5 storm. And then you go to 2010. We had 19 named storms, 12 of those hurricanes, but none of those hurricanes impact the United States. So, again, use a seasonal forecast as a way to get people to understand, know that the season is upcoming and it's time for preparedness. But as far as that, really there's not a lot of utility in the seasonal forecast on an individual preparedness basis.
Right. Okay, Nader Meraveri, I'm sorry, can you comment on reports that the European UK Center, ECMWF, I hope you know what that means, had forecasted Hurricane Sandy hitting the New York and New Jersey regions as early as 8 days ahead of time? Are they using tools and techniques that are not available to NOAA?
Yes, if you remember the slide a couple slides ago, I'm not sure that I can. Can I go back?
Tell me what number it is, and I can try to bring
probably it up. About 44, 45.
All right, I'll try to get that one up.
Let's go back two more. Go to 42.
Okay. One more.
The this does illustrate here that the European model was the first to predict Sandy's turn back towards the United States. The European model is good model. For the past two or three hurricane seasons, it was the best model, and kind of one of the metrics we look at is a two-day forecast and compare all the models, and it was the best at 2 days, I believe, for either two or three hurricane seasons in a row. This past year, the U.S. GFS model actually edged the European model out at that two-day metric. And I would just say that yes, the Europeans do have some different tools and techniques that they are doing. That model is finer resolution than the current U.S. model. But really and truly, I would say that both the GFS and European are the two models that we rely on here the most at the Hurricane Center. And I would just caution folks, again, when they're looking at some of the model guidance, is trust the Hurricane Center forecast. The models, we may have reasons why we believe or go with various models at various times. And as you saw with that slide, looking at the 5-, 6-, and 7-day forecast, the Hurricane Center does tend to beat these individual models in the long range, say for an entire season. Perhaps the individual forecast time periods, the models might beat us, but over the long haul, the Hurricane Center generally does outperforms most of the individual models.
Thank you. I'm going to insert a question here. pardon me, of my own. As you mentioned, from storm to storm, you may have varying levels of confidence in the forecast that you pick up in the tropical weather discussion. Or tropical cyclone discussion, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Has the National Hurricane Center ever considered trying to quantify the level of uncertainty in the forecast by storm?
That's a really good question. We more or less subjectively talk about forecast confidence in our tropical cyclone discussion. You'll see us talk about the model spread, and it really is our confidence in the forecast is often dictated by really the spread of the guidance. Some of you may be familiar with some products that we issue called wind speed probability products, and these actually provide you what the chances of receiving a tropical storm, a 58-mile-per-hour, and also hurricane-force winds at individual locations. The technique that actually produces those uses our past errors to help compute those chances, but that technique also takes into account this model spread and has varying confidence levels. Typically, when the spread of the models is lower, the Hurricane Center forecasts are better, and we have actually thought about using that same technique where it looks at the spread of the models to have varying cone sizes in such that in cases in which the spread of the models is low and we have high confidence, the spread of the cone or the cone size would be actually a little smaller. And then when it's there's a lot less confidence in the forecast, more uncertainty, the cone will be larger. We have not gotten to the point to incorporate that yet. Again, it's something we've thought about, but if we do, I think at that point we probably would put something in the discussion that would quantify it, such as confidence in this forecast is low, medium, or high, and that could be something that might be done in the future, because I think we want to include that somewhere within our products, because there are others that do make that do use our numbers to make their own cones, and then this would provide them guidance as to which cone size we're going to employ for a given forecast scenario. But again, right now none of this is occurring. Our cone size stays the same for the entire forecast for the entire season and is not based on model spread.
Okay. James Lewis Free asks, does the National Hurricane Center have plans to significantly update its platform of real-time maps and infuse them with GIS? Are there plans, also second question, are there plans to eliminate all cap text products, and thanks for the great presentation.
Yes, the first question, the Hurricane Center has a lot of its products already available in GIS format, but yes, we would like to do more and better products in GIS. Some of that is a resource limitation currently, but over time, hopefully, we will continue to provide more in GIS. Some of the storm surge inundation and other things, we would like to get that not only as a static graphic but also in GIS. I forgot what was the second part of the question now.
This is the use of caps and
The use of caps, the Weather Service. Why we use all caps goes back to the days of really the teletype and the World Meteorological Organization, making sure that all our products get down kind of to the lowest dissemination method. But that regulation was recently loosened by the World Meteorological Organization, and the Weather Service has begun to experiment with mixed case products. The Hurricane Center was, we were thinking about trying that with our tropical cyclone discussion for this upcoming hurricane season. But because of technical resource limitations, that will be we'll wait at least until 2014, because we just had higher priority projects and things that, like you saw me present here, that we really wanted to get out the door first before we spent the time to go to the mixed case. But hopefully, during the next few years, you'll see us start embracing the mixed case like other parts of the Weather Service have.
Very good. Thank you. Ray Pena asks, it seems you use cyclone and hurricane interchangeably. Why not stick with hurricane? FYI, I've also heard cyclone used interchangeably with tornado. Wouldn't hurt to clarify that a little bit here.
Yeah, and I know that when we do presentations, we sometimes get a little bit into the technical jargon. And I use the term tropical cyclone because it really is a catch-all for tropical depressions, tropical storms, and hurricanes. All of those are classified as tropical cyclones, and a tropical cyclone then is classified using its wind speed into the depression, storm, and hurricane categories. So that's why we sometimes lump the word tropical cyclone to mean all of those depression, storms, and hurricanes. The post-tropical cyclone is a term that simply means it is no longer a tropical cyclone. It was once one, but is no longer. And that term, we've been using it for a couple years or a few years, but it, of course, got the widespread use during Sandy, in which then the media really began to coin the term superstorm.
It is time for us to wrap up, but I just wanted to pop in one last question, if you can answer it briefly, Daniel. I appreciate it. You talked about the improvement program, the 10-year program, and is there anything on the horizon there that you think holds promise for improvements in the intensity forecast?
There is one. The early results have shown promise. When the NOAA Hurricane Hunters fly out into the storms, those aircraft have Doppler radar data, Doppler radar on the aircraft, and can collect this Doppler radar data. That has been used to initialize some of these higher resolution models and shows some promise. As I mentioned during the discussion, that one difficulty we have is being able to observe the current structure of the storm, and having that data into the models to accurately depict the current structure of the storm goes a long way to helping the forecast. And, we don't get the aircraft data, especially from the NOAA aircraft, all that much. But, again, this is something that is starting to hold some promise and could potentially be helpful in the future. It probably will be several years, though.
Wonderful. Okay, it is time to wrap it up. So on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants, thank you very much, Daniel, for joining us today and sharing this information with us. And while we hope that the 2013 season will not be too active, we do wish you the best.
And thank you. If anybody has any follow-up questions or wants to email me, certainly willing you're willing to do that.
And on the folks, before you run off, please do take a moment to give us some feedback. And if you have any further questions for Daniel, you can actually put them in the comment, and we'll get them on to him. Our next program is scheduled for May 8th, when we will feature the Silver Jackets program, an initiative that provides an opportunity to bring together multiple state, federal, and sometimes tribal and local agencies to learn from one another and apply their knowledge to reduce risk from flooding. Our guests will include the National Program Manager, Jennifer Dunn, as well as a number of regional and state participants. So please do make plans to join us then. Thanks to everyone for participating today. Thank you for your questions. We hope you have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.